Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. Barracuda Networks, innovators of hybrid on-premises and virtual solutions for content security, network optimization, and data storage, benefiting more than 100,000 organizations worldwide. Barracuda.com. And the Walter S. Johnson Foundation.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. On today's show, thousands of students and teachers protest public education cuts. We'll hear from some of them. And it's official. Jerry Brown is running for governor, saying he's the one to bring fiscal sanity back to California.
I did slow government spending from what the growth pattern under Ronald Reagan. There's no question. I was a frugal governor. I built up a rainy day fund, which was the largest surplus in the history of the state.
Also changing the rules for bear hunting in California.
Essentially, I'm here to make sure we don't decimate the bear population. We can have fewer bears. We can have more bears. But we can't have no bears.
And singer Loudon Wainwright on why L.A. is such a tough town. It's the California Report.
No cuts, no peace.
Years of pent-up frustration and anger over K-12 funding cuts and rising college tuitions spilled into the streets of California this week. It was part of a national day of action for public education. Up and down the state, demonstrations targeted larger class sizes, teacher layoffs, and higher student fees. We fanned out across the state talking with protesters, including Scott Burton from San Diego State University.
People are really angry, so I think that it doesn't surprise me. When people get angry, they want to make their voices heard, and they want to tell the people in charge that they're mad and that they should pay attention to us.
Education is under attack.
My name's Akasha Perez. I'm a junior political science major. As far as I go personally, it's been difficult for me to get classes. The budget cuts have caused the fee increases, which have meant that I had to take on another job. So I'm working 40 hours a week. I'm taking 17 units. So it's been a lot of push. I can also feel the morale definitely from the lecturers that don't feel the job security and from the students that don't know if they're going to get their classes, don't know if they're going to be able to finish their majors.
Lisa Weston, and I am the chapter president at the California Faculty Association over at Fresno State. Budget battles often pit K-12 through against higher ed, and that's just wrong. It should be K through infinity as far as we're concerned. Education is seamless.
James Zuki, I'm a third grade teacher here at Feinstein Elementary School, San Francisco, California. We're protesting these draconian cuts. They're going to affect these kids directly. Some of the teachers at this school are being consolidated, laid off. The district is talking about having 27 to 30 kids per classroom, kindergarten through third grade. And the kids understand that that's not the classroom they want to be in.
My name is Jessica Nesbitt. I am a junior transfer student here at UC Berkeley. I study gender and women's studies. I am out today because the fee increases are absolutely untenable and unnecessary. I mean, there are so many gross misuses of funds in the system right now that this is not necessarily the only way to accomplish what they need to accomplish.
They say cut back! We say fight back! They say cut back! We say fight back!
My name's Aaron Milligan Green. And, you know, I mean, I'm here to support the cause. I'm a student myself up at the GAC. You know, last semester, fall 2009, they cut 430 classes at the Santa Rosa JC. I mean, I have friends who are having trouble getting into state schools, even though they have a grade point average, 3.6 or higher.
So let me remind you, all leaders challenge the process. If you're not challenging the process, you're not leading. You're here because you're a leader.
One possible source of school funding dried up this week when California failed to make the final cut for federal education funding from President Obama's Race to the Top reform program. The president is also pushing charter schools, but they're controversial, in part because they don't always reach students who need help the most. But Adolfo Guzman Lopez of KPCC in Los Angeles reports on one charter school working to get high school diplomas in the hands of students who've all but given up trying.
Dominic Corey and Carlos Cruz climbed into Corey's 2007 black Chevy Impala on a recent morning to start their work as chasers for Learning Works Charter School in Pasadena. The school enrolls students who are chronic dropouts. Many have been kicked out of several public schools. The chaser's job is to help students by nearly any means necessary to finish their high school studies. Corey stops his Impala to drop off homework for an 18-year-old who'd ignored her studies the last several months.
Hi, Juana.
Hi.
How you doing today?
It's the algebra, right?
Hey, you got a job? Where did you get your first check?
The
18th. Oh, we're going to eat. So you taking us out to eat?
Two of the school's founding principles are forgiveness and unconditional love.
Juana, we got it. You know you're graduating this year, Juana, so don't use work as an excuse of why you're not going to come in and why you're not going to use go to finish your work. You know I love you, and we've been through everything, Juana.
Some chasers, including Corey and Cruz, are former dropouts themselves. For this unconventional school, their perspective is essential to motivating students. Learning Works follows an independent study model. Chasers collect and distribute homework and take students to court, mental health, and Planned Parenthood appointments. At the next stop, Carlos Cruz describes how the student living at this house hadn't shown up to school in a month. Cruz said the boy's father is in jail and his grandfather was recently diagnosed with cancer.
Chris, I know you in there, man. Open up.
No one answers the door. When Cruz calls his cell phone, the student says he's in a neighborhood a couple of miles away.
What you mean? I've been stalking for like a whole month straight. Never answer your phone. You said you was going to have some work done. Then when I text you, you don't answer. What's up with you, man?
Cruz urges the student to think about his long-term future.
I know you're going through some stuff, bro, but can't let that stuff get in between your education, bro. Just imagine, I already had this conversation with you. What happens if your grandparents go and you don't have the skills to take care of their properties? What's going to happen then?
Many of the school students have served time in juvenile hall for serious crimes. Others are recovering from heavy drug use. And pregnancy has caused some of the female students to leave school. The school's founder, Michaela Ron, says she came up with the Learning Works model of intervention, intensive support, and customized learning after years of seeing failed public school efforts to turn around dropouts.
The number one binding force, though, of dropouts is poverty. We really see ourselves as a laboratory of poverty because every student that I look at is really living some condition of that. And they've been living independently for years, whether it's that the parents don't exist or that, in essence, the parent lost control years ago.
Ron, a PhD in education policy, said the 300-student school graduated 42 students last year. That's a big achievement, given each student's academic history.
The fourth root of 9 squared.
Math tutor Ruth Richardson helped 16-year-old Michael with a math lesson.
I'm almost done with my module.
Easy or hard?
It's whatever.
The parts of it are like review, and then parts of it are really challenging.
Students are required to come to campus at least 1 hour a week and attend a weekly field trip. They must turn in assignments, whether they work on them at school or at home. Sometimes all this extra help is not enough. Back on the streets, the dropout chasers are looking for 18-year-old Jamie Lewis. Cruz describes him as a roller coaster kid, someone who does well in school for a couple of months, then gets in trouble. Just before Thanksgiving, Cruz said, Lewis came to the Learning Works campus to turn in his homework. He was arrested later that day.
So then he calls me. He's like, because he has my number and his mom wasn't answering the 1-800 number. He calls me. He's like, can you like tell my mom I'm locked up right now? I need somebody to help me.
Cruz did help him get out of jail. And that kind of support convinced Lewis someone cared about him finishing school.
What do you think about the work that they're doing?
It's pretty good.
Are they helping you?
Yes. Teaching me how to finish school without dropping out.
tell me a little bit about that. What's been happening with you the last, like, year?
I haven't been doing my work, and I got to get on my work because I got to graduate this year.
Learning Works Charter School is poised to grow in the next couple of years. It's already trained half a dozen other academic tutors, including a young woman, as new dropout chasers. For the California Report, I'm Adolfo Guzman Lopez in Los Angeles.
The name Jerry Brown is a kind of political Rorschach test in California. Flaky, soft on crime, tree-hugger to some, brilliant, ahead of his time, visionary to others. In 1974, at the age of 36, Brown became the youngest person ever elected governor of California. This week, the 71-year-old attorney general set out to win back his former job, and if he does, he'll become the oldest governor ever elected here. Sacramento Bureau Chief John Myers caught up with Jerry Brown in Santa Monica this week and asked about the roots of California's budget mess.
There is some discussion as to whether those roots stretch back to your time as governor, and I'm wondering what you think about some of those analyses. I mean, people talk about that there might have been too little investment in higher education, too little investment in infrastructure. Any chance are there any of your fingerprints on any of those roots?
Well, that's an interesting question because some of the Republican critics are saying, well, there wasn't enough money spent, as you say. And then the other hand, they say, wait a minute, you spent too much money. So there is an incoherence in the critique of my opponents.
But even not just Republicans. I mean, some people just who try to look at for the historical view of what was going on in the 70s.
Well, I did slow government spending from what the growth pattern under Ronald Reagan. There's no question. I was a frugal governor. I built up a rainy day fund, which was the largest surplus in the history of the state. And that $5 billion that I fought hard for against legislative efforts to spend was the real salvation after Proposition 13 cut two-thirds of the property tax in local government. So I helped the schools and the fire departments and the police departments because we had the money. Today, we have the opposite. We have a gaping hole, a gigantic deficit. And so the challenge now is to work with the legislators, not play the blame game, look at every aspect of the budget, engage every legislator, all 120, and then share it with the people. All the people that legislators listen to, they have to be part of the solution too.
A lot of discussion this week, as you've announced, about your evolution in politics, all the different things that you've done, the ways that you've approached the whole craft. I guess the question I wanted to ask you is, you know, the public sometimes is cynical about politics and about politicians. How does the public distinguish evolving as a politician might, as a lot of folks say you have, from somebody who sticks their finger in the wind and says, wherever you want to go, I'll go that way?
Well, that's a good question. I have a consistent record of fighting for the environment, fighting for workers' rights, taking the position in support of the underdog, and pioneering new ideas. So I have a consistency. Now, do I have to make adjustments? I do. I oppose Proposition 13. The people made it into law. My oath is to carry out the law, and I did.
Well, Prop 13 is actually something I wanted to talk to you about, and it's going to get talked about a lot. There's no surprise to that. I noticed that you told one reporter in the beginning of this conversation this week that there's a unique factor to being in place at the beginning when something happens and now, and you can see how the policy has moved over time. No example to me covering government comes to mind more than Prop 13. Does Prop 13 work looking at it from then and from now?
Well, Prop 13 does work. As a matter of fact, with the turnover in property, the property tax revenues have climbed significantly over the decades. And some people don't realize that, but that happens to be the fact. And we do need more stable revenue sources. That's a problem. The income tax is very volatile.
Well, I guess this is the perfect time to ask you then more about taxes and about revenue because, as you said in the announcement, you said again here, no taxes in this economy without a vote of the people. That's a paraphrase of what you said in the video announcement. Not sure I know what that means exactly. I don't want to parse words too badly, but does that mean that you'd solve the current, like, $20 billion problem with just cuts?
That's where we start. And we don't expect it to be finished in 12 months. It's going to take several years. It's taken a long time to get into this fiscal hole. It will take a long time to climb out. when people are out of work, losing their homes, I'm not going to be saying you ought to be paying more taxes.
So is it just – I mean, what else could you do then if you're not going to raise taxes? There's taxes, there's taxes and cuts.
Well, what have we done in the last couple of years? We've had to borrow, and we're going to have to use financing to get us through the next couple of years.
There is this notion that you are kind of poised to run this populism campaign and to talk about populist issues, attacks on corporate America. That may be a very easy target if you look at least one of the candidates and maybe both on the Republican side. Do you see the campaign framed in those kind of political themes?
Well, I think if a candidate says, look, I have mega hundreds of millions. I've been a CEO, therefore I can run California. That certainly opens up the whole discussion of the role of corporate America in whether or not there was enough supervision on Wall Street or whether it was too much. And I would argue that the $7 trillion wipeout of American wealth by the unregulated profit-taking on Wall Street is an example of where government was needed and it was absent. So I'm going to present a very balanced approach. And my hunch is that we have to transcend our political origins and forge a common undertaking, Californians first. That's what I see.
You seem excited.
I am. It's a very exciting undertaking to take over so many years after I did it before, but with a lot more knowledge and insight and appreciation for both the difficulties and the fantastic dynamism of California and its people.
Jerry Brown, thanks for the time.
Thank you.
And you can hear the whole interview with Jerry Brown on John's blog, Capital Notes. There's a link on our website, californiareport.org. Well, now we go from brown to black. Black bears, that is. The Department of Fish and Game is proposing changes to regulations to expand where and how Californians can hunt bears. Lisa Morehouse went to a bear hunting clinic in Diamond Springs, that's near Placerville, and has this report.
Jim Williams and John Waddles have hunted together for 30 years. They're two of the instructors at today's clinic.
That's a call a sow makes in heat. That is one way to get the bear to come to you.
They're teaching the crowd about hunting with bows, not guns. They ask class members to attach drawings of lungs, a heart, and a liver to a poster of a bear.
Someplace like that.
Each year, the Department of Fish and Game holds 18 advanced hunter education clinics like this one throughout California. Robbie Samples came here from Redding. At a lunch break, she explains why she brought her 12 and 13-year-old sons.
They get to see these animals that are in their own habitat and living. And really, hunting is, I think, probably one of the most humane ways of you know, supplying your family with food, because these animals get to enjoy being animals until the very last moment when they don't, instead of being raised on a feedlot.
What do you look for out in the woods in order to find a bear? You
know, Mark Kenyon is a biologist with the Department of Fish and Game. He jokes that you won't find bear crossing signs out in the woods.
What you will find, however, are some foraging sign, some tracks, some scat, which is a fancy scientific word for bear droppings.
Kenyon's the statewide coordinator for black bear, mountain lion, and wild pig programs.
Essentially, I'm here to make sure we don't decimate the bear population. We can have fewer bears. We can have more bears. But we can't have no bears.
He says there were roughly 38,000 black bears in California last year.
The bear population's been doing wonderfully the past few years. Population's been increasing.
In April, the California Fish and Game Commission will vote on proposed changes to bear hunting. One key regulation would stay the same, only one bear killed per hunter each season. Currently, the season ends when they've reached a certain number of bears killed. They're now proposing to end it on a date, the end of December. That's a couple weeks later than the season closed this past year. Kenyon anticipates no more than 2,300 bears will be killed each year under the new proposals.
We find these proposals unsporting, reckless, and totally unjustified.
Jennifer Fearing is California's senior state director for the Humane Society of the United States.
They are eliminating, absolutely, the annual quota for bears, and they're extending the hunt into a county, San Luis Obispo County, that's never permitted bear hunting before. So without a doubt, it's certain that the number of bears killed will increase. increase.
The Humane Society is especially opposed to hunting with dogs, including the current use of radio tracking collars and the new proposal to allow GPS collars.
When you're using packs of dogs to run through the forest and they're equipped with collars that allow you to know where they are and what they're doing, that's not hunting. That's not sport. We consider that to be, you know, wildlife harassment. And it puts the dogs in a compromised welfare position itself.
But at the clinic, Josh Bronis, a member of California Houndsmen for Conservation, vehemently disagrees.
There's nothing that's unsporting or unnatural or unfair about the use of dogs.
After his fellow houndsman demonstrates the use of radio collars, Bronis gives an impassioned history about hunting with dogs, and he encourages hunters to know the regulations backwards and forwards and report illegal poachers.
Stay in the good graces of the public, stay in the good graces of the wardens, and then do what we can to ensure that hunting is going to be a pastime that future generations of Americans can enjoy.
About 10 miles away, students learn the basics of field dressing a bear.
Just like most other wild game, you can field dress it on the ground or you can hang it.
Instructors show how to hide the bear and salt it for preservation, how to report their kill, and what to take to the taxidermist. People concerned by this practice and those who support hunting rights can all weigh in. Public comment on an environmental impact statement will be open through March 13th. And the Fish and Game Commission will hear opinions on the proposed changes to bear hunting regulations through mid-April. For the California Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse in Diamond Springs.
And to hunt down information on how to file your comments with the state, follow the tracks to our website, californiareport.org. This week, our occasional series on California songs continues with Loudon Wainwright III. The Grammy winner and sometime actor famously draws inspiration from just about everything, from his life and family to politics. He casts himself as the protagonist in his songs, which are confessional and intimate. On Gray in L.A., he looks at the upside when bad weather hits sunny Southern California.
Hi, it's Loudon Wainwright III. Well, Gray in L.A., was written in Woodland Hills, California, which is on the outskirts of Los Angeles County. And it was in the winter time, and we were getting lots of rain and gray weather, and I had a carport in this house that we were living in at that point, and the sound, the drumming sound of the rain on the tin carport, I would say more than anything else, drove me to write Gray in L.A.
When it's gray in L.A., I sure like it that way. 'Cause there's way too much sunshine around here. I don't know about you, I get so sick of blue skies wherever they always appear.
Too much of a good thing can be not such a good thing. When the weather's great down there, it's fine. Then after a while, it just gets to you, or it got to me at any rate. And on a gray day or a rainy day, it was kind of a release, actually, to get some moisture.
And I suppose that the closed canyon roads and the freeways will all start to clog. And the waters will rise, and you won't be surprised when your whole house smells like a wet dog. When it's gray and so cool. Yeah, it might feel like fun when you sport sunglasses, but really you're just one more fool.
It's a marketplace. It's a place where people go to get movies made and acting jobs. So it's a pretty rough town. I mean, I've lived in some big cities. I've lived in New York. I've lived in London. But I'd have to say that Los Angeles is probably, the most career-oriented place. There's more desperation there than most places I've tried to ply my trade in.
And I'm just a chump, and this whole town's a dump. We came out here to dump all our dreams. A
I've been going to L.A. to work since the very early 70s, maybe even the late 60s. So that's 40 years. It still feels like you're the new kid in town. I don't know why that is, but you always feel like you just got there. It's very strange. Okay, I should stay here. There's no place that's better, I know. The last time I went to L.A., I won a Grammy. So, you know, hey, that was a good trip. I don't know about you. I get so sick of blue skies wherever they always appear.
That was Loudon Wainwright III talking about his song Gray in L.A. You can find it on Strange Weirdos, music from and inspired by the film Knocked Up. Los Angeles is a town where awards really matter, and this weekend, dozens of Hollywood insiders are hoping to win the most coveted honor of all, an Academy Award. On Sunday, Hollywood stars will saunter down the red carpet in front of the Kodak Theater, and while everyone's focusing on their clothes and jewelry, the red carpet itself is mostly overlooked. But rolling out the 500-foot, 5-ton red carpet takes a crew of more than 300 carpenters, engineers, and producers. It takes about 10 days and 600 man-hours. Joe Lewis heads production for all the pre-show action on the red carpet.
It's a very big undertaking. It takes an army of very qualified people doing their job diligently to get this done.
Lewis is no stranger to orchestrating large events. He's worked on 8 Super Bowls and managed several pre-production shows for the Emmys.
The favorite part of all of these jobs and why I'm in the business is to watch these things come to fruition, start at the concept stage, go into full-on development and production and build, and then the most glorifying point of it is knocking it all down and starting over on the next one.
This year, like every other year, Lewis and his crew will miss the actual awards ceremony. They'll be too busy rolling up the red carpet after everyone's inside the theater, a feat that takes 36 hours. That's our show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocha. Paul Ancour is our engineer, with help from Danny Bringer and Howard Gelman. Our interns are Caitlin Esch, Jennifer Bidas, Tracy Sharman, Kelly Mahan, and Julia Simon. Gabriel Cohen is our online editor. The producer is Victoria Maleon. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. The news director is Bruce Kuhn. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by Chevron, an energy company encouraging innovation right here in California. This is the power of human energy. Information available at chevroncalifornia.com. The California Healthcare Foundation, sponsor of calqualitycare.org, a new online guide to long-term care in California. And URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. URSCorp.com.